recorded in Los Gatos, California, on January 11th, 2016. This is GeekSpeak, episode 2 of our 16th season. You're listening to Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at kosp.org. It's time now for GeekSpeak. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the Geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Brian Young. He's a CG artist and iOS developer and a lifelong tinkerer. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing, Lyle?
Quite well, thank you. We also have Mr. Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie.
Hello.
And come back from a brief break. We haven't seen you since last year. Mr. Ben Jaffe, a teacher, traveler, and music geek. What have you been up to, Ben?
What's up?
Has it been a whole year?
Well, I guess. I don't know.
Did you travel the globe this time?
I did not. I took a staycation.
Nice.
So you're away back from you guys.
You're back now. Sorry. What have you seen? Anything interesting lately?
Well, I now work at Facebook.
Oh.
Which is exciting. You all knew that.
The company with the blue F logo?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
They make fun of on a regular basis on the show?
I think Ben makes fun of it too.
No. I don't. I don't make fun of it.
Well, not
at
anymore.
At least you don't anymore.
So you work there now. Well, right now, do you have a specific job? I mean, you're a UI engineer, but do you work in a certain department?
I run the ice cream shop. Yeah.
What a way to go.
You were talking about ice cream earlier. They got free ice cream there?
Yeah, I have a cookie with me. Yeah. From the ice cream shop.
This is why you work there, right? It's because of ice cream and cookies?
It's the cookies and the cupcakes, yeah. Yeah, I'm going to be doing front-end web development. And cool. Right now I'm going through the boot camp program, so that means I'm learning.
You find your feet and then get placed somewhere or find out
where
you're going
to go? I
know
where my feet are, but...
That's cool.
Metaphorically.
Cool. Well, you'll have to keep it surprised as the job turns into a real thing.
Definitely. Yeah. Can I tell you about something else I saw?
Please. Love to.
I went to the Computer History Museum. The other day.
Mountain View.
You've been, Lyle. Have you been?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Brian, you've been? Miles?
Nope.
Oh, you gotta go, Miles. It's very cool.
Miles, no. Okay, well, a couple things. Just two things. First of all, as someone who doesn't know much about World War II, but really likes cryptography, as little as I know about it, they have an actual Enigma machine.
One of the German Enigma machines?
Yeah.
Whoa, cool.
So they have that machine. I got to see it, and that was amazing. It's also in...
Is that the one that the U.S. found on a U-boat?
Yeah, U-110.
Wait, that the U.S. found on a U-boat?
Oh, wait.
I was poking at you, Miles, to say something.
Of course.
Miles hates inaccuracies in films, especially historically associated ones. Yeah. You want to tell us what
especially happened? Films like U-571 or whatever it's called, because yes, there was a U-boat named U-571, and no American set foot on it and stole its Enigma machine, and it was completely made up from whole cloth and maybe like, you know, smelling the vapors of something that may have happened. But
a British guy actually stole an Enigma from U-boat 110. And actually, 2 days ago, that guy passed away.
Oh.
So that's a little bit of news. And yesterday, I saw an Enigma machine, and that's a bit of news.
What does it look like? How big is it?
It looks kind of like a big boxy typewriter.
A big boxy typewriter.
Big boxy typewriter, yeah.
And I know that there's disks inside of it with different, they're disks and gears, and they turn around, and you can reposition them, and you get... If you put data in, you get consistently output, but something that's very hard to figure out how it was produced.
Right. And so if you don't have the actual settings for the Enigma machine and the machine itself, then you can't really decode the output from the input.
I wouldn't say you can't decode it.
I didn't say I can't decode it. I said you can't really decode it back around that time at the scale that they needed to decode that number of messages.
What do you mean, Brian? You can now?
Well, no, they didn't have having the code book was not the reason why they were able to figure out how the Enigma machine works or how to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the process of figuring out how it worked and decoding the messages, once they understood what the limits of it were and the way it was basically set up, they were able to decode messages through a process of trial and error and then testing.
Very fast machine trial and error, pre-computer or physical computer machine trial and error.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool.
For reference, see the movie Imitation Game.
Good game.
Yeah.
Again, full of inaccuracies, but good game. Good movie.
I also got to see Babbage's Difference Engine, which is a very large mechanical calculator, weighs several tons. I want to say 50 tons. I think the number might be wrong, though.
And this isn't something he built, right? This is something that he designed?
This is something he designed on paper. It has an incredible number of very complicated gears, and it's the kind of thing where I can't even imagine how you'd go about beginning to design something like this.
Yeah.
And then because of typographical errors that would often be propagated by people manually copying numbers from one book to another, or one book to the typesetting machines, he also built a typesetter which connects to the machine, and the machine actually changes the all of the different individual numbers and everything, and then blots paper, blots ink, and then blots paper, and blots ink, and blots paper. So the output of the Babbage machine, which it's tabulating polynomial functions, actually gets recorded on a physical piece of paper as well.
Right. That was actually the real goal he had, was to make sure that there was tables of accurate data.
Right.
Because engineers use these tables to build stuff.
Yeah.
And so if you have a wrong data, no one actually knows that the data is wrong, and somebody's physically putting it in. So this thing was an automated process that actually created the right values without human error.
Yeah.
But of course, he couldn't build at the time because they didn't have the machining.
He did build a piece of it. Which they called the beautiful fragment. Mm-hmm. And so he hired one of the best blacksmiths, and he built this thing. And actually, he was building the entire thing, and then he actually had to stop because the British government was like, we're giving you money. Where is our machine? Like, you're not done with it already? And he's like, okay, well, maybe I'll just build a small piece of it just to show off, you know?
Sounds like a software engineer to me.
Right. And then eventually bad stuff happened and he had to stop working on it. So he never finished.
If you're in California, go to to the Computer History Museum in Mountain View. It's open, I think, 3 days a week. Something like that.
No, it's more than that. I think it's five. Actually, I'm not sure. But I do have to say briefly that there is another one of these. Actually, the London Science Museum has a Difference Engine. And they wanted to build the typesetter, and they didn't have enough money. And then so they approached, I think Bill Gates walked through, and they approached him, and he said, actually, you might want to talk to this person, COO of whatever. And they talked to that person. And that person was like, okay, fine, I'll give you money to build this this other part of the machine, provided that you also build an entire machine for me, including the printing press, and I'll pay for all of it.
Oh,
and so they
cool.
did. So there are two machines in the world. One of them is in London in a basement. You can't see it. One of them is at the Computer History Museum, and it is going back home to
the private owner.
Yeah, to the private owner. So if you want to see it, I highly recommend you do. You got to go soon. So
now, software was written for this machine.
Is it called software?
It basically is. It's an algorithm, and it's a series of processes made for that particular hardware, written by who would be the very first software programmer in the world.
Oh, of course, yes.
Ada Lovelace.
Cool. So she wrote for this the Babbage machine?
Mm-hmm.
But the Babbage machine didn't run anything because it didn't exist.
Right. It was
conceptual.
Theoretical.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Really cool stuff. Also, the rest of the museum is fantastic as well. I should just say that.
Miles, you don't work at Google anymore, but I'm going to ask you to do Google story. Would you mind?
No problem.
It might be easier now that you don't work at Google, right?
Yeah. A funny thing about Google Translate is that it doesn't actually translate word for word. It's one of the reasons why it did better than predecessors, even though it has some issues. One of those issues came up where the way that it translates is it looks at patterns for how someone spoke in one language and looks for patterns in another document that's similar and then makes correlations between them and is able to figure out the syntactic structure.
And this makes sense because when you really think about translating, you can't actually translate perfectly between two languages because
right.
there's different meaning. And the great example that I always use is in French, you can say déjà vu. And the reason why you understand the idea of déjà vu is because we use the French word. But if you don't have that word to talk about déjà vu, you have to express the entire, you have to tell a story about what it means and feels like. And therefore, language is coupled very closely to thought. And so translating from one language to another language, it's better to actually try to translate the meaning of the thought. And that's where the ambiguity comes from.
Yeah. Although déjà vu, strictly speaking, in French means already seen.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But Google Translate was translating some documents from Ukrainian. The Ukrainians are not particularly thrilled with Russia right now for their annexation of Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's tension.
Yes. And so many documents of that were translated from Ukrainian, excuse me, to other languages, translated Russia as Mordor, and Russians became occupiers.
Wait, this is just an automatic thing that happened?
Yeah. Like,
and so Google Translate was spitting out those translations.
Yes. In the Lord of the Rings trilogies, the evil place is Mordor.
Yeah.
So it's a fictional place.
Oh, who hasn't seen the Lord of the Rings movies by now?
Created by Tolkien. I think it's fantastic, Mordor.
So what is Google using as like the corpus to figure this stuff out? Is it, do they feed Tolkien in there to help?
No, they feed in the data.
They feed in input from what people have written. And there
you can kind of think of it as metaphor, right? Because from the Crimean perspective, Mordor is probably correct term, right? Like that does probably relate an effective way of referring.
I think Russia is colder than Mordor, but that's a whole other.
It's bigger too, but the point is that when you're looking at you're using machine learning to figure out how to translate, this is the kind of side effects that would occur. It's very much like speaking in metaphor, and it makes sense because that's kind of how languages get produced and are used.
Well, like if Google was using the entire web that it crawls as its corpus and trying to categorize things.
Yeah. So that would be unwise. That would lead to a lot of profanity.
And lead kittens. To profanity
and kittens, yeah.
And how do you figure out simple things like just the meaning of hot and cold in the context? How do you categorize that?
You hire a whole bunch of PhD researchers. And then they all
work.
And you throw a bunch of money at them, and
and you probably
and they work on it for a couple of decades.
You probably also need a labeled training set as well, somewhere along the way.
Yeah, labeled training set for all languages. I mean, there's a giant amount of data. It's like doesn't even make any sense. You can imagine that there's other. So these ones are funny and kind of like interesting.
Well,
but they're funny
to us. They're probably not funny to
right,
a lot
but
of
it's,
people.
But it's the same principle that went behind, or it's a similar principle to what happened where a Republican presidential candidate was associated with a unsavory
that was highly,
body product.
That was highly intentional.
It was.
What was
and
the
this
again?
One? And this one was also fairly intentional in that people were referring to Russia as Mordor.
Okay.
We're making these allusions in general comments, and that got picked up and put into the translate.
Hmm. But Savage Lud podcast,
Dan Savage
created Santorum intentionally because he hated Senator Santorum. So he took that word and defined it a certain way and had all of his followers define it the same way. And I think it still points
right.
to...
So if you have a whole bunch,
if you search for Santorum, it's a really...
Just dumb.
Not a pleasant thing to read about, and I can't talk about it on air. But that was completely done by pushing this kind of system.
But that's the whole thing, is they put data... in the way that Google gathers data, they figure that out by links. You made a whole bunch of links, and you did what is often referred to as a Google bomb. And this is just another aspect of that. You're throwing a bunch of data that gets hoovered up and gets digested and comes out
in an altered way. So the point of all of this
is
to say who's to say that the translation is wrong? For somebody out there, it's entirely correct.
That was kind of my leaning is that... So we think of this, what I was trying to say earlier is we think of this as kind of funny and interesting and a side effect of these kind of things, and it's brought to light and it's ridiculous. Of course, everybody knows that Mordor is not the right term for Russia. And at the same time, people get the connection of why a certain people would use that term. The other side of this, though, for me, is more interesting in the sense that there's a subtlety that occurs here where there's potentially a feedback of translation that occurs based off of these rule sets, and the subtle ones are going to be the ones that are going to be trickier. And I don't have a good example of this, except for to go really drastically. When you determine in politics a term, and you use that term all the time, and other people use that term, you've won your argument. And a great example of this is...
death tax?
Death tax, but let's do right to life or freedom pro-choice.
Yeah, so right? pro-life or pro-choice.
If you use pro-life, you have to argue that that's the way you want to go. And if you use pro-choice, you're arguing that direction. So by using the phrase, you actually define your stance. And if other people use that phrase, you've won the argument. And that happens all throughout dialogue and politic.
Yeah.
So this means that our algorithms are defining how things are translated between languages and therefore get to embed some kind of their own meaning.
Well, it's a translator, so you've got two sides, but both sides don't have to know what the other sees or hears. So depending on which side of the line you're on, you could get a different...
Have you ever used a utilities where it bounces back and forth between a language multiple times
I can
until
imagine.
It doesn't change anymore?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ooh, so,
you
real
a, yeah, so you hit a steady state. So you type in your original statement. It goes back and forth.
So you type in something in English. You have it translated to Spanish. Then you have that statement translated to English. Then back and forth until they don't change anymore.
Yeah.
And
or Japanese. I think
of course,
it was one
of those. They're different than what you originally wrote. Kind of like the telephone
much
game.
Much different. Yeah. And oftentimes hilarious.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And just, you know, poor Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, because he got translated to sad little horse.
Google Translate woes. Thank you very much. Thank you very
much. That's the problem with machine learning is, you know, people say computers are stupid, and that's definitely true. But with machine learning, I mean, they can go even further. They can just be disruptive and confusing.
Brian, do you have like an Internet of Things kind of story by chance?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So a couple weeks ago, I was talking about my kids getting toys and a little robot thing. Well, my kids have all sorts of technology, and one of the things they have, they don't use it so much anymore. They're kind of outgrowing it, but it's called this V reader. It's a tiny little touch-based device for reading, and it comes from a company called VTech. Now, we didn't cover this story as far as I know, but a couple months ago, VTech got hacked. And the reason why it's particularly notable is because millions and millions of both child and parent records got out into the hacker's hands.
What kind of records does the company have?
Well, it's things like email addresses, okay. Things like photos where kids and parents were encouraged to take selfies on their different many different systems they have. But we've covered a lot of hacking stories, and nobody likes to hear this, and it's really unfortunate. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because this very same company has decided to release at CES this year a whole line of Internet of Things products, a whole line of things like security monitors and cameras that you can put in your house and all these other sensors you can put in your house.
And thinking, I know that company because last week they got hacked severely. I'm not putting one of their sensors in my home.
I just want to know, who in the world could possibly trust a company whose idea of keeping their stuff secure was so blazingly bad that they let the entire corpus of data out 2 months ago.
But aren't you talking about like 80% of companies?
It's true. It's true. And I want companies to be punished for mishandling their data.
Real punishment, not real like punishment. A little tiny fine, but a serious like.
No, yeah. the kind of punishment that you get in the market that if you show a severe lack of ability to secure your stuff, why should anybody ever
trust
you?
Well, here you go. You've got thousands of people listening to this show right now, so you're suggesting VTech might not be the best choice for security cameras because of their history of data integrity.
Absolutely. I think you should be really clear about
it. Congratulations, you just punished them.
Yeah, exactly.
Bear in mind, you are going to increase the cost of products as well.
Well, but isn't our security worth that?
I believe it is. Just saying, that is a logical consequence that you have to lengthen the development period to be able to handle security. That's going to add to the cost of the development and cost of product.
Yeah, and it also could reduce innovation. Totally aware of that.
I don't know about reducing innovation.
If you're slowing development cycles, then you're also going to reduce the speed of innovation, aren't you?
Not necessarily, because those same companies have to scramble to fix the mistake, and fixing the mistake after the product has been released is a lot more expensive and time-consuming than fixing it before it's released. The earlier you catch a problem in its development cycle, the cheaper and easier it is to fix.
You're listening to GeekSpeak. In a minute, we'll be back and talk all about, well, SSL and some new improvements. Stick with us, won't you? You're listening to GeekSpeak on Independent Public Radio, KUSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Brian Young, Miles Elam, and Ben Jaffe. All right. Let's talk a little bit. I'm always worried about bringing up extremely technical stuff on the show, because though this stuff affects your world completely, the understanding of it, the comprehension of it is complex. It's hard to understand, like the Babbage machine, right? And so I wanted to talk about SSL because some new really exciting improvements have happened and some big changes have occurred. And it's a living, breathing kind of pattern of technology. And we talked a lot about it on the show. The term we're using, SSL, we're actually talking about a stack of technologies, and the umbrella term is that, and it means a lot of things. But basically, when you visit a website and you do it securely, and there's a little padlock, you're using secure sockets layers, or SSL. And Miles, it's not called SSL anymore. What is it called?
TLS.
Transport Layer Security.
Okay. So even though it uses HTTPS, and we always call that SSL, it's now TLS.
So imagine that this is the layer of the network infrastructure that connects you with Facebook or Google or whatever, which makes sure that everything is secure.
Right.
So that way, if somebody grabs your data on the way to Google servers or on the way from Google to you, they can't decode it because it's encrypted, right?
And this all works off of private and public keys. And the general idea of this is that I make a math formula and I create a geekspeak.org private key. And this is a very large number.
And that one's private, hence the name.
Private. I never share it with anybody. It's my private key.
Okay.
And from that key, I make a public key. And that public key, I share with the world.
All right. So I have your public key, but I don't have your private key. Right. You're the only one who has both.
So if you take something and you encrypt it with my public key and you give it to me, I'm the only one that can see the data out of it.
Oh, okay. So I encrypt with your public key, and then Brian and Miles can't get that.
That's right.
So if they're trying to snatch my data on the way to you,
and even with your my public key, you can't really do anything about it. You can't see inside it. Also, the other thing that can happen with a private key is you can sign stuff with your private key, and anybody with a public key can see, oh, you were the signer.
Right. So I can verify, yes, this executable or this application came from Lyle, not from malicious Miles Elam.
That's right.
Because he might be posing as you and might be trying to get onto my machine.
And the one other pattern of this that has to function is that your computer has to trust that a certificate came from actual Lyle. So if Brian comes along and says, here's the geekspeak.org site, and they hand you something, Ben, and you look at it and go, well, I'm going to use this as an authority that's actually geekspeak.org, even though it was really Brian, that's a problem. And that would be a man-in-the-middle attack. So the way we do this is we use a trust network.
Okay, quick question. How does the security, or sorry, how does a certificate interact with your public or private keys?
So the certificate authority.
The certificate is the public key?
So the certificate, if you go to geekspeak.org right now, your browser will say, hey, give me geekspeak.org. And when that happens, a response will come back with a public key, the geekspeak.org public key.
Okay.
And the browser will look at the public key and say, has this key been signed by anybody I trust? And it's been signed by DigiCert, I think.
Well, the signature would then be, is a hash. Like you use a particular hashing engine of that information. And that's what you use. If you take that same information, recalculate with the hash, you're able to get the same information.
I just want to simplify it. So, I go to geekspeak.org. Let's say, Lyle, you're geekspeak.org. You send me your public key and some stuff. I want to verify that the stuff is from you, but you also give me a public key. The public key is from you. So what I do is I go to some trusted authority and I say, hey, is this public key actually geekspeak.org? And that trusted authority says, uh-huh.
That's not how it happens.
No. Okay.
No.
You want to do it? Yeah, Miles.
the signing the certificate authority has put its own signature onto the certificate. That's how you verify. There's no communication that goes between the certificate authority and they know nothing about.
So that means that when I get the public key, I can just by the way that it's signed, by some ishness, going to kind of fuzz over the math.
We'll
right?
fuzz over that for a second.
By some ishness, I'm able to verify that yes, indeed, this public key that's supposed to be from geekspeak.org is indeed from geekspeak.org because it's signed by this special authority that I trust.
And it's the fact that you have a list of the people that you trust that this all works.
Right.
As long as those people, the people that you trust, that these certificate authorities can hold their private keys in a place that nobody else can get them, the system works.
Right. So I have to trust.
Well, your browser right now has over 400 of these trusted things in your browser. And that trusted collection is what's important.
Okay.
So I have to get something signed by one of those trusted certificates, and then everything works.
Okay, got it.
Are we good with this?
Not quite everything, because there's one last link, which is the hashing algorithm used to generate that signature by the certificate authority.
Okay.
And that is the part that has been falling down.
This is the part we're kind of blurring over, signing it and making sure the signing works. All that is actually real complicated math based off of different algorithms. Mm-hmm. And some of these algorithms over time are shown to not be very good.
They're just showing their age. They were good for their time.
Just like the Enigma machine was good for its time.
Yes, absolutely. SHA-1, simple hash algorithm 1, is something that can be generated very fast and for its time made a unique hash. It would take quite a while to generate all the possibilities that you would get what's called a collision. And
this kind of means that you could theoretically keep on trying and keep on trying.
Signature.
Yeah. So Brian goes ahead and makes a geekspeak.org site and insects it and gives it to you, Ben. And what he's done is successfully created a fake one. And that's, I guess that's the best way to say it. So now you can't tell the difference. I think that we'll just leave it at that.
Okay,
even though it's more complicated than that. But we'll just
right.
Yeah, MD5 being another one that was dropped recently.
And the reason this happens is because the algorithm is so quick that you can have a machine calculate millions of them a second. And if you calculate the millions of a second, and eventually you'll hit a collision, which means you'll have the same one, you'll know what the number is, and you basically have the private key.
So you're saying this was secure in 1990. But it's not secure now. And the only thing that's really changed is that machines are much, 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 much faster.
That's right.
Well, and researchers have been looking at those algorithms and trying to find vulnerabilities in them. And that's something that has been found recently, a vulnerability in SHA-1 that reduces the key space that you have to deal with down to the equivalent, I believe, of about 64 bits.
Lots more than 128.
Which, yeah, 64 bits is about where you were at with browsers in 1995 for the international browsers, or 96, one of those.
So the important thing to know is if you have all the computers at the disposal of somebody like a government that can throw tons of money and build just a giant computer system, it's starting to get conceivable that maybe they could start getting these collisions and decrypting people's communication.
Not just the government. We're talking on the level of just a large corporation.
Yeah,
anyone who's well funded, a drug cartel could probably. That's in their means now.
Yeah, and just to clarify, whenever we say the word collision, that's the ding. Ah, I found it. I found the key. You know, that's the moment. What do we have after SHA-1? Do we have anything better?
We have lots of stuff.
Yeah, several.
Right.
Stuff. Yeah.
The thing that's interesting about this is that the way that security gets built into software is that, like, when I put the SSL certificate up for geekspeak.org and made sure it was encrypted, I didn't write any of that code, right? I just kind of cobbled together all this open source stuff and got a key from somebody and put it up. And the trick is that there's a tons of ways of doing these protocols. And so SHA-1 has been around. And theoretically, if somebody's communicating with the Geekspeak site and, like, Brian sticks in the middle and says, let's use SHA-1, and we both agree to that, all of a sudden we're using a protocol that's easy to defect. Even if I didn't want to, and even if you didn't want to, Ben, he can kind of interject and say, you should. And then all of a sudden we're negotiating the wrong kind of technology.
So wait, when a browser first talks to some website, there's a moment where it's not encrypted. There's a moment where they have to decide how are they going to talk to each other in a secure way. And if somebody is able to get themselves in between there, do what they call a man-in-the-middle attack, they can force the communication to be at a lesser level of encryption.
And it's kind of like the browser says, hey, server, this is me, and these are the protocols I support. And the server looks at that list and goes, oh, I support one of these, and chooses it. And if both of them theoretically negotiate this bad one, then you got a problem.
There's also the issue of signing certificates fraudulently. So you go to a site, you poison DNS, which is a common way of making you go to the wrong... It's like going in the phone book and rewriting a phone number.
You're changing my phone number in my book.
Combine those two, and you have no idea that you're not talking to your bank.
Because this bad protocol is around. So a change happened recently, right?
Right. And the certificate authorities are no longer, to my knowledge, issuing certificates with SHA-1.
That's good.
One of the things that browsers have been doing is just saying, we're not going to negotiate with SHA-1. It's old, bad protocol. So Mozilla Firefox dropped it beginning of this year.
And Google's been talking about dropping it for a while, and I think they were going to drop it too.
Yeah, they're planning on dropping it soon as well, as is Microsoft with Internet Explorer. Or actually, they're dropping the old versions of Internet Explorer, so that's kind of a problem solved. But the issue is that it's not just sites that you're going to that need to have these certificates. You also have things that were man-in-the-middle attacks, except they're intentional and people accept them. They're the ones at companies where you are connecting to a proxy server and you need to go out and find out if there's antivirus software, like you have to run the antivirus software to see if they're going something.
A company wants to protect its outside border, so it has all of its users inside the company go through one piece of hardware and software configuration, and that thing investigates the packets and the data that's being transferred and stops some things. Virus is a perfect example of this.
Yes.
So there's like a boundary layer, but that requires the browser to engage with that boundary layer and the boundary layer to proxy all the tech.
It's
including
like
the encryption.
It's like a door with a doorman, and you put all of the employees going outside of the door out through that one door and coming in through that one door.
Right. And so let's say that doorman is really fluent in Russian, and all the browsers are fluent in Russian until the 1st of 2016, and all the Mozilla browsers are like, I don't speak Russian, and all of a sudden the doorman's like, well, that's it. No. You know, we're done.
Yeah, and that's what happened is many of these security scanners, these devices or antivirus products are failing to connect from end to end, from the browser to that middle point to the sites outside. And unfortunately, companies are caught in the middle because they may not have any control over that security device or that antivirus software because they're not the vendor. Switching over to some other product may be cost prohibitive, even if they understand what's going on in the first place.
All they know is that they're now open to problems, and they can't necessarily do what they need to do to fix it.
Additionally, we talked about Mozilla turning this off. Chrome actually uses the local the operating system certificate store, but it also has some built-in detection of inappropriate certs. So
yeah, they call it certificate pinning.
Yeah, so that's slightly different. And that's why the Firefox browser actually broke in some ways because Mozilla was being more aggressive on turning this off than Microsoft or OS 10. I don't know if OS 10 turned it off or not, but for Chrome on a Windows machine, it's actually the operating system's certs that are problematic potentially. Have we lost everybody at this point?
I just want to kind of give a very high level, very high level, which is that this is exactly the problem that we run into again and again in the tech world, which is where we have some old tech and we have some new tech, and we definitely want to use the new tech. But the problem is that we've relied on the old tech in so many ways and for so long that you can't just turn it off.
Yeah.
If you just turn it off, uncountable things break. Things that you just totally take for granted break, like your antivirus software being able to connect to the outside or whatever it is. And that's exactly, that's one of the problems that I guess if you're in IT, you have to negotiate on a daily basis.
Yeah, I do want to call some security companies to task, though. If you have a company that is marketing itself as security, have some security device or antivirus device or whatever, and they're breaking because of the SHA-1
behind the times. Severely.
This has been coming for a long time.
I agree.
Like, if you're in the security field, you should have known about this 10 years ago.
So let's now that we've talked a little bit about the protocol having to grow over time and change, another side effect of this, the reason why SSL and using TLS specifically is so important is that if you're not using that, all your communications can be looked at and sniffed, and it's in the public. And we've found that it's quite important to start securing everything because you can do some really bad effects if you don't use this protocol. You basically don't know the truth of the communication.
Right.
So wait a second. Before I understood how this worked, I was always confused how somebody could wiretap me, sniff my traffic when it's not encrypted.
So when it's not encrypted, it's relatively easy if you're on the same subnet. And that's the trick, is that we found that the government actually taps trunk lines, and therefore they're in the subnet, if you will. They get access to the traffic and they can record all of it.
They're along the route.
They're along the route.
Right.
Anybody that's along the route, basically.
Right. So it's not just the schmo sitting next to you at the coffee shop who's looking nefarious with his black hoodie. It's actually...
Although they are an issue.
they're certainly an issue. But it's actually entities that have access to the lines themselves, which we, until Edward Snowden wouldn't have thought to this extent.
It used to be like, for me, if I was at home at my own network and I was plugged into a jack and
you're
I was
safe.
Getting, you know, accessing a mail server without encryption, I was like, nah, it's probably okay. Because, you can't, it'd be really hard to be somebody that could sniff it and who really cares if they look at my data. But now that we take that level, we just go, let's stop thinking that way. Let's always encrypt all our communication.
Right.
And so this last year, I went ahead and got an SSL cert, and I was able to get an SSL cert for free by filling out a form and stuff for the geekspeak.org site, and I put it up a while ago. I'm not forcing people to use it, but it's there if people want to use it. And in doing that, I had to go through kind of a lot of rigmarole to do that, and I actually contacted one of the geeks in Southern California, Alex Slias, who's a security expert, and he gave me the algorithm soup that I had to put in my config file to actually get it to work really well, which was really nice to have an expert like that. So that level of complexity to do that, and I didn't want to spend a lot of money to actually get an expensive cert, so I just got the kind of cheaper one. Setting all that up was kind of a deterrent, and it's always been kind of difficult. It wasn't bad, but for me it was fine. But for most people, it's extremely bad. And I have to do it again in a year. Like, you have to redo this every year.
Well, wait a second. Have you checked to see what the standards are throughout the year? Have they changed such that you should have rearranged your...
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I don't think I've got SHA-1 in there. But yeah. No, that's what I'm saying. My setup is going to degrade.
No, if it came from Alex, you don't have SHA-1
in there. No, I know.
We trust Alex.
So, Brian, there's actually been a movement to fix kind of this problem of having individuals have to get a cert and the complexity around that, right?
Yeah. So we mentioned Edward Snowden. Ever since the information came out from what he had to share with the world, is there's been this huge move to encrypt as much as we can. And the result of that has been that this organization called Let's Encrypt has created itself, and it's been built up by many different companies and other stakeholders.
I think the EFF has been a big part of it.
Yes, absolutely. And what they've done is they've tried to make it as easy as possible for a website, or I believe it can apply to beyond websites, but for a website to turn on
SSL.
HTTPS.
HTTPS.
Thank you.
Hypertext Transfer Protocol Secure.
Yeah.
Blah, 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 blah. So no one ever says that.
What all of this means is that there are now scripts out there that somebody who runs a server can fairly easily go out and download, and with normal web servers like Apache and Nginx, install this on Linux, and it'll be available on other operating systems as well. And these scripts go ahead and do all of this hard lifting, all of this regular checking of with the certificate authority and generating the certificate and proving that this web server is the web server that it claims to be at the base level.
So when I got my certificate, what I had to do is I had to create an account at this other company. And I think it was, I'm not sure who, DigiCert or something. And then there I said, I want to make a certificate. And so what they did is they had to know that I had control of geekspeak.org. And so the way they did that is they sent me an email to admin@geekspeak.org. That's one way to authenticate. If I can check that email, theoretically I have ownership of the domain. The other way to do it is, and Google does this for authenticating a site, if you have like a Google page, what you do is Google gives you a long hash and you actually put that in the index file of your website inside a comment or a meta tag. And so I take something from them that they send me, and then I put it on my website. Then they crawl my website and they go, oh, look at that. There's the key we gave them. We know that this guy we're communicating is the person that owns that site.
Right.
So you're saying is that Let's Encrypt automates that process?
All of that's automated. And when you got your certificate, how much did you have to pay?
I didn't have to pay anything because I looked for a free one.
Okay.
But normally you have to pay like $150 or so.
Right. So what Let's Encrypt is trying to do is to make it so that the normal communication on the web is going to be encrypted. And to do that, they had to make free certificates. They had to make the entire process easy to do. And they had to make it automated so that as these certificates expire, they get instantly updated to the new one. In fact, it used to be that you'd get a certificate for many years, and that was a little insecure, and it reduced it to a year. And this is going to allow the system to reduce the length of time the certificate lasts to be months, maybe weeks, maybe even days.
That's very cool. So basically, all the time it can upgrade.
Right. So if a certificate was ever found to be bad, the great thing about the certificate system is that they all will expire. And if that expiration date is very short, then that rogue certificate that's gotten out that can now be decrypted by someone mm-hmm. else, there's only so much time that it could be used.
That's very cool. That makes a lot of sense. And that's especially important for these small servers that go up and down. Like when you transfer domains to another service provider, theoretically, the other service provider has access to your drive and maybe they have access to your certificate. So there's a question there. So if you have it kind of resolving all the time and cleaning up after itself all the time, you have a little bit more security. So very cool. So if you run your own servers, definitely take a look at letsencrypt.org.
And you mentioned the EFF. I always love opportunities to plug them. They're the people who sue the U.S. government when nobody else will. I love their shirts. I donated to them, and I got this shirt, and it has a unicorn on it.
That's a cool shirt.
Yeah, and this is actually the reason I hate winter, is because I can't wear my EFF shirt. I have it covered with a sweatshirt all the time.
Hey, in a minute, we're going to talk about Star Wars, baby.
No spoilers.
No spoilers, just some Star Wars. A little bit about browsers, some NVIDIA Chrome stuff, and we'll be right back here on KOSP. This is GeekSpeak. It's GeekSpeak on 88.9 KOSP and KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxel. I'm speaking with Brian Young, Miles Elam, and Ben Jaffe. And Miles, you said that you actually forgot something about the SHA-1.
Yes, Firefox broke so many things that they reverted the change. So SHA-1 is back into Firefox if you get the most recent build.
So it's not secure again?
Well, you can go in and change some settings so that it does drop SHA-1 again manually. But for the time being, they want people to be happy and continue using their browser. So.
Yeah, that makes right. sense. Especially since it didn't break in other browsers, and therefore people might make
exactly.
it away. And so.
That same problem we're always dealing with is, you know, nobody wants to take the plunge.
Ben, you missed a couple episodes ago. After GeekSpeak, after the actual air GeekSpeak, we talked for about 25 minutes about Star Wars
did
and all the spoilers and stuff.
You spoiler alerted.
Yeah. Okay, we did good. Spoiler it. So good. Two episodes ago, actually episode 0 of 2016 season, it has all about us afterwards, us talking about Star Wars spoilers.
That's a good start.
Yeah, I thought it was a fun way to start that.
It was a good movie.
Yeah, so but you're not going to do spoilers.
I'm not going to talk about that movie at all. So Bloomberg came out with a graphics story, just a really nice, long, pretty website, with a bunch of statistics about the use of the Force in Star Wars. And I've never seen a write-up like this. I'm more of a Star Trek fan, but I like Star Wars, and this is awesome. So I'm gonna give you a couple facts. I'm also going to do a little quiz. I'm just curious who's gonna win. So first question is, how many minutes and seconds do you think on-screen Force time, all six movies, episodes 1 through 6?
All effective Force?
All of the moments that people are using the Force in some way.
Does this include using a lightsaber?
I don't think so, no.
Does it include using a lightsaber if you're blinded?
I don't know.
Because when Luke is, parrying with his blindfolds, that's being used in the Force, right?
I'm sure
that's
that
unambiguously.
Included.
But
okay,
at the
but
same
what
time,
about someone shoots you with a blaster and you deflect it with a lightsaber?
Yeah,
that's using the Force, right?
Actually, technically, anytime someone uses a lightsaber, they're using the Force.
Yeah, but how can Han do that in Empire Strikes Back?
The deflection of a blaster bolt with a lightsaber, a saber throw in which a lightsaber is used as a spinning projectile, those are all Force usages. Yeah.
Okay. And then, of course, like levitation and telling someone to turn around and go somewhere else.
But
and
mastery of the lightsaber, of course, it requires the use of the Force, but they limit the Force time in battles to observed blaster bolt deflections and saber throws.
Okay.
And all the
okay.
They limit
all
the time to a fraction of a second.
Yeah. That's hard to do.
Let's go with an
average of 40 seconds per film.
40 seconds per film?
40 seconds?
Average.
That's all.
Well, just think about Empire.
Yeah, the training of Luke by Yoda. That
what about?
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry
about
for the spoilers on that one.
What about the Force dream of walking
into
the
let's
tunnel?
Let's see. No, I don't think the dream is Force.
Oh, that's got to be the Force.
No, no. Yeah. I mean, lifting
Wait.
Everything. Let's go with maybe Empire has more. I don't know.
So all,
but not a lot.
All six movies. I just want a number from all of you.
Okay. I'll stick with I'll say 1 minute per average. 1 minute per movie.
So 6 minutes.
6 minutes total.
Miles, Brian?
We're not getting
I have the number in front of me, so I don't want to...
Oh, Miles, you read
cheater.
This.
Okay.
Yeah.
So. Just tell me, how wrong am I?
I glanced it, but I didn't actually see the number. I'm going to say 15 minutes.
34 minutes.
Ooh.
34
wow.
minutes of first Force time. Yeah. They
for
also,
six titles.
They also break it down by how much using the light side and how much using the dark side. The light side is 25 minutes. The dark side is 9.5 minutes.
Well, so that you don't feel left out on this, Ben, how many times did Next Generation break the Prime Directive?
Oh, geez. 17 violations of the Prime Directive. I believe that was near the end of the series by Picard. So I would guess 22.
Nerd. That's what you win. I don't have the answer in front of me, so that's all I can say.
If a listener knows a correction, I'd love to know.
Definitely.
So wait. Why is Star Trek considered more nerdy than Star Wars?
No, he knew the answer. All of us, we didn't know. Actually, he knew an answer. It was like quoted from the show.
No, I'm just bringing it up because inherently that feels like it's true, is it?
Well, that it's more nerdy?
That it's considered more nerdy.
Star Trek tries to use typical physics, even though they have faster than light speed, but
they justify it using somewhat realistic physics-ish things. Like the warp drive, for example, they talk about it being an LQBA drive, which is an actual idea and is actually posited to be possible.
Star Wars has that too. A metachloroid's caused the force, so there's that. Don't hit me.
Okay.
MacGuffins aside.
Who used the Force the most and who used the Force the least?
Empire. I mean, the Emperor probably used it the most. That's my guess. Oh, I guess Luke's on screen so much longer.
Yeah, I would say Luke.
Yeah.
All right, Luke.
But
yeah, that's
all
right.
All six films?
Who uses it the least?
Oh, it's got to be Leia, right?
Of the people that can use it? Yeah, Leia, that's good because she only uses the moment. And she's like, I detect him.
That's 10 seconds. Darth Maul only at 8 seconds.
Oh,
he just waves his hand and like
you know
blasts
what?
Away something.
You know what? Darth Maul held off two Jedi at the same time. You cannot tell me that there was no Force involved.
Palpatine.
Oh my God, we're all nerds.
Palpatine was less than 4 minutes. I'm just gonna read these off because these are pretty cool. Right. They tallied 10 different kinds of Force abilities.
Wait, Palpatine used the Force?
He does. Yeah.
Palpatine. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The sure. crazy
Force lightning.
Force lightning. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. There's a I love these names. Force leap, telekinesis, force push, the sense, force lightning, Jedi mind trick.
Okay, I want to play a role playing game of Star Wars again. That's so
force
much fun.
Force spirit, telepathy, force choke, and burst of speed. Which is a brief, swift sprint that occurs quickly enough to create the illusion of disappearance.
And it makes you look like you're digitally affected.
Did they have also come back from the dead?
Force spirit.
Yeah, right. Force spirit.
Force ghost.
Yeah. Every time you're seeing the dead.
Definitely. Yeah, there force it is. Ghosts? There it is. Force spirit communication by a deceased force user with the living, either purely verbally or through a physical projection. Boom. Who uses
Aren't
that?
Are you
the
glad
most?
You oh, know yeah. all this information now? Congratulations, you're listening to Geek Speak here on KOSP. Okay, let's move on, shall we?
Yeah, I didn't mention all of it, so go to the website, geekspeak.org, click on the link.
Actually, can I say one thing? Because it's really cool that they mapped out all six films in a way that they basically, if you imagine a film as a timeline, and you've got all six timelines stacked on top of each other, that it shows when each... bit of the Force was used.
Yeah, so you get little slivers.
Yeah, you get this whole mapping out of the whole film at a glance. You can see it. But what's cool to me is when you make films, especially these special effects films, but this is true with most films these days, the production designer, the art designer, they'll sit down and they make what they call a color script. And that color script will just map out the entire film in the same way where you can see in one glance, as if everything was on a film strip, you can see how the colors and the mood and
the cinematography
changes. Yeah, the cinematography changes throughout the whole film just in one glance. And they're doing the same thing for the Force here.
Oh, yeah, that's really cool. That's cool. Visual effect. You can see this all at geekspeak.org.
Interactive too, so you can hover over them and see all kinds of stuff.
Awesome. Cool. Well, let's talk about NVIDIA, I guess. Miles?
So one of the things that people like to do, myself included, is use incognito mode. For myself, it's whenever I'm logging in for someone else to go to their banking. That way I don't have access to their credentials.
Why are you logging other people's stuff?
Because my wife needs to do her bank stuff, and so my laptop's available. And
So you use incognito window, and that way it doesn't save all the cookies and all that. You're not
right. So you're a good person. Rather than make her a separate user account and let her leave herself logged in accidentally someday.
That's what I do with my kids. It's much easier.
Anyway, long story. But most people who use incognito mode use it for porn.
Oh, really?
Pretty sure.
Okay. That makes sense. I mean, that's what the internet is for.
Incognito
right?
mode on your browser is a mode where you don't save cookies, which means that as your
or any information, caches, or anything.
So basically,
like that.
You open a tab in incognito mode, you do stuff, you close it, and now it's all gone from your computer.
So
your ISP, however, knows exactly what you're doing.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, so you're telling me the privacy mode on our browsers is used mostly for porn. Now, how would you know that the privacy mode is used mostly for that?
Because there are innumerable discussions and jokes online about porn mode.
Right.
In fact,
the privacy mode.
Some companies even refer to it as porn mode.
So it's not necessarily based on empirical data, but it's a well-known fact, I think.
Yeah.
General known
assumption. Is that a fact then?
Thank you. I was about to correct myself. I thought, no one's going to call
me. No, but we're all beaten. So
yeah, and there are some people that just use incognito mode because they want to always browse the web this way. And then there are some people who honestly do use incognito mode to buy gifts for people so they won't know on a shared computer.
I think that we as web developers probably all use incognito mode to see what it looks like when we're not logged in.
Yes, I was going to say that. I was just doing that today for work. I had to log in as a different user so I could try something, but I didn't want to keep the cache around. So instead of like clearing cookies and all that stuff, I just made an incognito window and there you go.
There it is.
So long story short, a whole lot of people rely on this feature to do whatever they're going to do.
Yes.
And it has worked generally well, except one person came across something rather odd when he was, you know, looking at some porn and then went, okay, I'm all done. Now I'm going to bring up Diablo 3. He's playing the game. And at the very beginning, there's the screen just goes to black and you're waiting for the loading for the game to load up.
And they place ads there, right?
Well, no, it's just... It's supposed to just be a black screen. However, what happened was with the NVIDIA drivers and with collusion with Chrome not wiping the GPU memory, what was in the GPU memory was displayed to the screen. And so he saw the site that he had been looking at displayed in his splash screen for the game he was playing next. The GPU memory ended up being a privacy hole.
So what happens is if you're like the website I'm looking at right now and an article that I'm covering for GeekSpeak, those pixels that are being painted onto my screen, they're not just magically appearing there. They're being put into a location in my computer, in my graphics processing unit, and being stored there in the memory. And whenever I need to bring up something else, maybe that memory might be reallocated and just wiped over, maybe not. But the bug you're talking about is that those pixels stuck around, even though the window was closed, the page was closed, maybe the browser was closed. Mm-hmm. Those pixels were still just hanging around there in memory. And eventually they were going to be written over, but somehow they ended up being displayed.
Because modern browsers are more advanced and they're trying to eke out every little bit of speed, they are heavily using the GPU, whereas older generations of browsers did not.
And this specifically was HTML5 video and a codec that was actually being decrypted or de-encoded on the GPU. So all that had to be stored on the GPU because it was de-encrypting the MT.
But it had the whole page layout.
I doubt that.
There's a screenshot. It has the entire page layout.
It's also...
There are some black spots in there.
Well, think about it. I mean, with OS X, every window is basically a polygon on your graphics card.
Yeah. It's also possible that the entire page was somehow the thing is, it has to be accelerated.
It has to be completely... Oh, yeah. Okay, and CSS acceleration. Yeah. Interesting.
GPU accelerated. Anyway.
Odd. So at any rate... not to worry, this will be fixed soon, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. You'll get an NVIDIA driver update. And for any of those that don't want any embarrassments, you know, go for that update. And Chrome is quite likely to also do some GPU scrubbing because they have access to that memory. They were simply closing the browser and expecting the driver to wipe that out, which it should have.
Chrome will fix it before NVIDIA fixes it.
Sure. And to be clear, this is not something that's likely to happen often.
Right, and it's like, also not something that you could lose data from. Only your machine, the person in front of the computer would know. But it would be embarrassing if you like shared the computer with somebody else.
Yeah, it's a data leak rather than a data loss.
Right.
And in most cases, the next thing that would use the GPU
would
clear it so quickly that you just wouldn't see the image or be just a quick flash. The egregious thing here is it just happened to get into a situation where that was held on screen for a long time.
Because of Blizzard's bad coding.
Because it was loading.
Well, no, not bad coding. I mean, Diablo 3 is just a really complex game. You have to pre-calculate a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah, okay. Brian, can you do a Facebook story, please?
So this is a quick one. And really, this is less about Facebook and it's more about us. Because we all know that the big companies, especially companies like Facebook, Netflix, Google, Apple, they all do tests, and they want to understand their users. They want to understand how people use their software. They want to improve it for everybody. And some of these tests sometimes weird people out a little bit. Well, this was a particularly egregious test because Facebook wanted to see how much they could inconvenience users before they would stop using Facebook. So with some Android users, they would literally make the Facebook app crash when they opened it up. So every time they opened up Facebook, if they were in this test, it's a small group of people, every time they'd open up Facebook, it would crash.
Crash once or?
No, every time.
So they just couldn't use it?
No, they could because invariably, what would happen is that they would then go to their web browser and load up Facebook.
So you want to see how high a barrier they had to do?
So essentially, what the test proved is there was virtually nothing they could do to keep their users away from using Facebook because they would find another way to get back to
it. So why do they even have an app? That's fantastic. I mean, if I approached some of our product managers here and said, you know what I want to do? I want to do a test where we're just going to crash Netflix a lot. I don't think anyone would go with that. I don't think that would be a win. No,
but just
so
imagine.
there was no side effect effectively.
Well, effectively, that's what it showed is that people wanted to use it so much that they would go to that much inconvenience to find a way to get to it.
You know what that's crashing for me lately is Google Mail on my phone. It just keeps crashing every time I open a document. Crash, crash, crash. I'm going to have to uninstall it and install something else.
You know what happens?
I wonder if it's a test. just Google testing.
On a smart TV, Netflix works just fine until I actually want to play something.
Play a movie?
Yeah. Then it says, try again in 10 seconds.
You're in that fail test. All right. Maybe we'll talk about A-B tests sometimes to really explain how they work, because it's really an amazing way of developing software, and all these companies are doing it. Hey, if you'd like to communicate with us and to talk to us, we'd love to have your communication up at multiple locations, geekspeak.org. You can email us, geeks@geekspeak.org, or you can find us on Twitter and on Facebook. We're KOSP Geeks. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and his user permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like it. You can even make money off it. Just let them know who we are. This is Independent Public Radio 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz and streaming live worldwide at KOSP.org. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is the GeekSpeak episode 2 of our 16th season. Ben, Miles, and Brian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Always a pleasure.
See ya.
Got one more quick story? We got 20 seconds.
What about IE?
Oh, sure. Yeah, IE 8 and 9 and 10 are there. Microsoft is end-of-lifing them. Tomorrow, as we record this on January 11th, if you're listening to this episode, they've already done it.
Go get Chrome or Firefox.
Yeah, or IE 11. That'd be fine too.
See you next week.